peace deal has been signed between the US and Iran. Donald Trump will hope that this solidifies what was a shaky ceasefire born out of fraught relationships within the region and a resounding lack of confidence back at home. But has the United States emerged as the loser of the war they started? And where does this new deal leave Iran and Israel? And most importantly, can it hold? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And the Trump administration has said it is prepared to allow the establishment of a $300 billion investment fund for Iran as Tehran agrees to a final settlement to end the war that includes a nuclear deal. The offer resembles a similar step the Obama administration took in 2015, with one key difference: the amount offered is much larger.
It is doubtful that any agreement that arises is going to be significantly different or a significant improvement from the deal that we had in the first place and had worked for a long stretch of time before the United States pulled out of it.
The decision has previously been criticized by Donald Trump himself. But while some may see the funding as an admission of guilt or the only pathway to peace, other key players like Israel are left in limbo. What is this deal really offering? And can it withstand the pressure in the region? Well, joining me now to discuss this is Gina London, international communications strategist and trainer, and Borzu Deraji, longtime foreign correspondent and founder of Badlands Newsletter. Good afternoon to you both. You're both very, very welcome to News Talk Daily. I'm going to come to you first, Borzu, because when I tell my children, right, that I'm going into a negotiation, or they say, what are you doing today, Mum? And I say, oh, I have a big meeting on. The question I get asked every evening by my five-year-old is, did you win or did you lose? Right? There is no nuance here. You're a winner or you're a loser when you come out of negotiations. So I'm going to apply her five-year-old reasoning and logic to this agreement, to this deal. Are America the losers here?
Yes. You know, when you play chess, you can take all of the opponent's pawns, even take maybe a couple knights and a bishop, and your opponent can still defeat you if they play the game well. So it doesn't matter that the U.S. destroyed Iran's Air Force and Navy and hit all these other targets and so on. The bottom line is that Iran checkmated the United States, put it in a position where even Trump admitted that in 4 weeks, the U.S. strategic oil reserves would run out, the U.S. economy would collapse, or at least go into some sort of depression. The world economy is already in trouble. And basically, the United States can pretend that it's a nation of warriors, but that's just a live-action role play. In reality, the United States is a nation of lawyers and accountants, and they did the smart thing by basically withdrawing from this conflict at the moment that they did.
Gina, I wonder, is that the way the Americans are seeing it at home, that Trump was backed into a corner here, a war that he doesn't really think know why he started and wasn't quite sure how to get out of?
Well, look, the American people in particular, they're not going to be reading the details of this memorandum of understanding. What they're going to be looking at is whether their gas, for farmers, their fertilizer, inflation, what's happening in their wallets is going to be changing. And that's what matters most to them. And of course, the high fuel prices at the pump and the ever encroaching midterm elections are something that's really of a big concern to not only the American people, but also to the American politicians. And Trump has been tired of this war. He thought it was going to get over quicker than it is, and he needed to get out. I think one big challenge, though, is that the conservatives who supported the military action under his own party are now asking whether this agreement will achieve any of the war's stated objectives, certainly, which initially included regime change and is nowhere on this now. Several prominent Republicans have voiced their opinion publicly about whether those sanctions relief that are being offered are going to be in sequence sufficient with concessions from Iran, or will Iran be doing the concessions and then the sanctions will be relieved. So there's still a lot more questions that need to be answered even after the MOU is officially signed in the formal proceedings in Switzerland. But the hawks, I think, that supported this war because they believed it would weaken Iran, now see that this deal is probably going to end up strengthening Iran because they've seen, Iran, that the Strait of Hormuz is their leverage tool from now into the future.
Yeah, they now realize they have an arsenal that perhaps they didn't know they had in the past. Let's just go back, I suppose, to, I mean, some people are calling it a peace deal. It really is more a framework, isn't it? What happens immediately, Borzu?
Well, I think that what's going to happen immediately is that they're going to meet in Geneva. And rather than have this formal signing agreement that was the original plan, and I'm not sure why the original plan changed, it seems that it was signed electronically. They're going to start the negotiations. They're going to start trying to hammer out the details that are in this memorandum of understanding, which is more of a framework agreement than a actual agreement. There are a number of points to be discussed. But I think that one thing also that will happen immediately is that some of the frozen funds will be released to Iran. And we're not exactly sure how much. Are we talking $6 billion, $12 billion U.S. dollars, $24 billion U.S. dollars, even more? Iran claims there are $120 billion in frozen funds in various bank accounts around the world. Some of that will be released immediately. That was the cost of entry for these talks from the Iranians to the U.S.
And those foreign assets that were frozen that are going to be released, it's clear within this MOU that Iran can use those for any purpose.
I think it is pretty clear, but I think that the U.S. has some assurances that because they are still held in those foreign accounts, see, the Iranians hold these monies in foreign accounts so they can use them to pay for imports. There will be some measure of transparency as to what that money is used for. But frankly, money is fungible. So even if they spend the $12 billion on medical supplies and food, they can spend another $12 billion on weapons and so on. So I think it's kind of a non-argument.
Okay, to look at the rest, I suppose, of this MOU and these sort of technical negotiations that are going to take place over the next 60 days, it includes this 300 billion euro for Iranian reconstruction. Where exactly is that money coming from? And what do you think the schedule to lift further sanctions on Iran is going to look like?
Well, I think in terms of the sanctions, that's going to be complicated because there are multiple jurisdictions involved. There's the U.S. Congress, there's the International Atomic Energy Agency, there's the UN. There are secondary sanctions imposed on other countries that have prompted those other countries to impose their own laws and sanctions. But as far as these $300 billion goes, I think that's more of a hypothetical. It's more of a theoretical incentive for Iran to be on its best behavior, this promise of a stabilization fund. You know, throughout the recent wars of the last 25 years or so, and in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in Gaza and Palestinian territories, there has always been these talk of these international kind of relief funds. And I think this will turn into one of those. Those often never came to fruition.
Let's look to the reopening of the strait, because as Gina said there, one of the big difficulties for Americans and indeed for people right around the world was the impact that this war was having on their back pocket, because the global economy was really choking here. The vast bulk of traffic along that strait was stopped. When are we going to see sort of a full resumption of traffic on that strait, do you think, Borzu?
I think it'll take weeks to get these ships rolling. Many of these ships might need some maintenance and repair. But look, and I'll be frank here, I think things are going to get a little bit worse in the global economy before they get any better, because you're going to have a huge backlog, a more than 100-day backlog of supplies, whether that's oil or gas or fertilizer precursors or helium, are reaching certain key ports. And that's going to cause strain. That's going to jack up prices. Sure, maybe futures markets will be calmed by the prospect of a resumption in normal trade. And that will help out, the derivatives trading and so on. That will keep those markets stable. But as far as the pocketbook, there's going to be a little bit of pain yet before things start to get back to normal, which might not be for a year or so.
Speaking of a year or so before we kind of see exactly where this is going to play out, I think it's going to be a year or so before we see what happens with that enriched uranium that was in Iran, which was apparently part of the reason that Trump attacked in the first place. There's going to be negotiations over 60 days. Those negotiations can be extended, and we've seen in the past those negotiations have taken years, but part of it is a plan for that uranium, a plan perhaps for inspections from the United States, a binding UN resolution, all to be agreed. Is the plan, Gina, around the uranium there and the nuclear capabilities of Iran, is that better potentially than what Barack Obama had when he had that agreement with Iran back in 2015, which Trump apparently hated and pulled out of?
No, not at this point. There's so much that needs to be decided or determined in the next 60 days plus, likely, because don't forget that JCPOA took years to negotiate and it had a lot more clarity. Right now, what we're seeing is a shakier and thinner version that we're hoping to get some more flesh onto through the negotiations, but it doesn't have anything right now in the MOU around the ballistic missiles and some of the other issues that were considered and were covered in the JCPOA. So there's a lot that has to happen. Right now, we're back to essentially status quo ante, which we're just back to where we started from. Of course, with much more that has happened, with the global economy being shaken, with 13 service people killed from the United States, and of course, hundreds and maybe thousands of people who've been killed in Iran, including, of course, the tragedy of those 120 school children. So there's a lot more that has happened. And I think another thing that we need to make sure to talk about is that the mistrust of the United States as it bombed on February 28th while negotiations were continuing is still something that Iran is going to be considering as it's going through these negotiations now. What's going to happen in two more years when there is a general election? And then is the new administration in the United States going to potentially tear up whatever this particular deal is, just like in 2018 when Trump tore up that JCPOA? I think there's a lot more to be concerned about than be thankful for, without just thinking, okay, now we've got the Strait reopening and we've got a ceasefire that is looking like it's going to go continuing on. And hey, finally, I get to go back and serve my clients in the Middle East region, which I couldn't do since the war began, and all these other particular people that are being impacted. I think the political reality is that there's a lot more at stake and concern that we are yet to hopefully find any kind of way out of. And it certainly won't happen in just 60 days.
Yeah, Boris, you can ask you about that. Do you think the new agreement will be any different than the one signed by the Obama administration in 2015?
I think it won't be any better. But I think it's a different time now, and there's different circumstances. I think the Iranian regime is different. You've got this guy, Mohammad Bakar Ghalibaf. He seems to be a more conventional type of politician. I've watched this guy for decades, really, and he's, you know, kind of the proper level of corrupt and ambitious that would make him a comfortable fit around the world in many political environments. He's not exactly just a zealot, as many previous Iranian politicians were. And so that might make the deal very different. It might make the aims of the deal very different. The goal of the JCPOA in 2015, to some extent, was to try to moderate some of Iran's policies and actions by offering them these economic incentives. And that did not happen at all. But this time it might, and that might create different ways in which the deal will help Iran integrate into the broader global economy and maybe even bring about some measure of stability and peace in the region.
What's been interesting is to watch how this has played out at the G7. I think there's been a big collective from all of the leaders there who didn't, let's face it, want to get involved in this war. And it was really interesting to see some of the commentary, you know, this sort of congratulatory tone towards Donald Trump for his strong leadership. Mark Carney saying it was a game changer. Is it, do you think, Borzu, or do you think there's just such a collective sigh of relief that at least now we have some framework here and that we do have a ceasefire and that we are going to see the reopening of the strait?
I think everyone in the world, except for a narrow sliver of people in the United States political body who are very loud and very influential and quite well funded, and Israel, sees this war for what it was, a huge mistake. disruption that is unnecessary, that was, you know, illegal and outside of the norms. Just like I think much of the world when at first Russia invaded Ukraine and did what it did there in 2022, they saw, much of the world saw it for what that was as well. Later on, people's opinions changed. But I think that, you know, there is a big, huge sigh of relief, regardless of what this deal entails. It's better for these two countries to be talking than to be at war. And it's, I think, to many people, better for some constraints put on Israel's militarism and ambitions. And if that war, if this peace agreement does bring that kind of situation about, I think everyone will be a little bit more relieved.
Lebanon used to be a great country. It was a country where you had professors, doctors, lawyers. The great intellect was in Lebanon. Now it's just, it's terrible. I'll tell you what, Israel's fighting Hezbollah too long and too many people are being killed. And you don't have to knock down an apartment house every time you're looking for somebody, because there are a lot of people in those apartment houses and they're not all Hezbollah, that I can tell you.
Okay, I want to talk about Israel now because this part of it has really fascinated me, Gina. I want to start, I suppose, by reminding people, what is it that Israel wanted to get out of this war?
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu, who before even 3 years ago when the Gaza war happened, he had been under corruption charges and there were protests in the streets. And so his political future had been shaky. He spent years arguing that Iran was a central threat to its country. So if this agreement actually holds, the voters, because there's an election that's expected for Netanyahu or against, puts him up for re-election by October, the voters may ask whether he helped eliminate that threat or if he simply helped everyone bring them back to a negotiating table that already existed. And so Israel was central to this war, as I mentioned. But interestingly, right now, as the MOU is written, it appears very peripheral. You hear more references to Lebanon than you do to actual Israel, as far as what I've seen from the briefing that was supplied to the press. So it's a big problem for Netanyahu, because if U.S. and Iran are cutting a deal that includes Lebanon, Hezbollah, and regional de-escalation, but Israel's not clearly driving those terms, then he has to go back and explain to the Israeli voters what this war has actually achieved. So right now, Trump's been publicly suggesting that Netanyahu should use a, quote, softer touch, but it's not language that the two leaders have agreed upon publicly.
I just wonder how Hezbollah are seeing all of this, Borzu. I mean, do they potentially see real benefits from this agreement, particularly if sanctions relief and the unfreezing of those Iranian assets actually increase Iran's ability to support their regional allies? And they're probably delighted to see any sort of tensions or fracturing in the relationship between Israel and the US.
Yeah, I think maybe they are happy to see that. But they've also lost a considerable bit, and they're struggling just to get back to where they were before this war. They think about it, that, you know, what up to one fifth of Lebanese land is now occupied by Israeli forces. And that's almost exclusively areas where the Hezbollah fighters, families and relatives and neighbors live. And so their community is completely devastated. So I think the priority is for Hezbollah, if this war draws down, if eventually Israel leaves southern Lebanon, is going to be restoring ties to the communities. There are also a lot of people in Lebanon, not just in the Sunni and Christian communities, but also in the Shia community that is where it's rooted, that are very angry at Hezbollah for getting involved in this conflict, and they will have to repair relations there. So I think in many ways, no matter what happens, it's never going to be more than a draw for Hezbollah in this conflict.
Without the United States, there would be no Israel. Without me, there would be no Israel, because no other president was willing to do what I did. I've had a great relationship with Bibi, but now Bibi has to be more responsible with respect to Lebanon.
What do you make of Trump's comments at the G7 about Benjamin Netanyahu? Is there, right, maybe this is the cynic in me, but is there a sense, right, from Donald Trump that we need to make Benjamin Netanyahu the fall guy here? We need to make him the lightning rod for this mistake because it actually distracts from the fact that I made a big mistake too?
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely his instinct. is to shift the accusations and blame and the excesses of the conflict onto someone else, whether that's J.D. Vance or Benjamin Netanyahu. That's been a pattern throughout his career. But I also think that he's basically, that was a very gratuitous remark to make, and he made it several times. I think it's part of a strategy to just distance the United States from Israel a little bit. I think he's angry, even if he doesn't say it, at the promises that he was given by the Israelis in the beginning of the conflict. According to the New York Times, he was told that this would be an easy win for the United States and Israel. And he feels deceived. And I think it's a little bit of revenge there against Netanyahu.
Yeah, and it possibly plays really well with his base. That's what we're hearing, aren't we, Gina? That they like the idea of Donald Trump standing up to Benjamin Netanyahu, calling him out.
Well, of course, look, that's, as Borzu said, it's absolutely the playbook for Donald Trump to say it was his idea to go into Iran with was going to be like Venezuela, and it was a regime change and everything was great and we've captured their oil. And then he was saying initially when they'd started the war that, oh, remember, he said, oh, Netanyahu didn't tell me this. This was my idea. This was our idea. He distanced himself from that. Well, now you see just the opposite happening, is he's trying to get himself out of here and reframe what happened at the beginning by saying, oh, it was his fault. It was he's the one. So of course he's going to be trying to play to his oversimplification narrative that he often does. That's his communication style, so that the MAGA people can feel around, yeah, we're still back in that winner, just like the guy who had his birthday over in the White House with the cage match. He's the winner. He's the big guy. And that's why when you saw that G7, I thought the communication styles from each of those leaders, from Merz in Germany to Meloni in Italy to, of course, Macron in France, and then as you were just saying earlier about the Mark Carney from Canada, every one of those leaders who said we don't support this war and that had been insulted by Donald Trump as a result, and of course Carney with the 51st state thing throughout the beginning of Trump's second term, all of them now had to do what they had to do and praise him for being the guy who's helping get us out of the war that they never wanted to get into, and there was no reason to start in the beginning. So, of course, Trump's going to try to repackage it to make him look the best that he can, like he always tries.
Borzu, to sort of wrap this up, right, there's going to be all these negotiations now over the 60 days. They can, of course, be extended. We know they could go on for months, they could go on for years. What should News Talk Daily listeners really look out for here?
Well, I think that just watching these negotiations go on is going to be interesting in of itself if you're a wonk like me. But in general, for average people, I think the thing that will be kind of most distinctive about these talks is I feel that the Iranians are going to just try to stretch this thing out as long as possible. They have no trust in the United States.
What do you think, Gina?
The rest of the world is hoping that this does come to some sort of, even if we go back to status quo, it's better than we are now. The problem, as I mentioned before, is that the Iranians do not trust the U.S. administration. And their concern is going to be, as they're going through these negotiations, is how much of this is going to be actually seen to fruition? How much is the United States going to maybe tear this peace accord up, if we get to some real details on it, in 2 years when a potential new administration comes in, the same way that Donald Trump tore up the JCPOA from 2015 and 2018 when he came in. So there are repercussions from this, even if we get some clarity on a ceasefire and a reopening of the strait and oil production and reconfiguration and some rebuilding in Iran. There still are going to be ripples for years, if not decades to come, from this war of choice just a few months ago.
What are the chances now of sort of Israel going it alone in this region? Because we know Netanyahu has this election coming up. We know this deal, this framework is universally hated, and we know they haven't achieved their objectives in Iran.
I'm not a Netanyahu expert, but if you look at the past of him, he will do what he needs to do to keep his political future alive. Now, that said, I don't know what that potentially means, but there can be a lot of background negotiations and a lot more things going on. He certainly kept Gaza going on much longer than the rest of the world expected or hoped or was frustrated with him that he was. Will he continue fighting in Lebanon? Will he try to do something against Iran? He probably won't be able to go alone. And if Trump in the United States says, we are actually going to let you hang out to dry, then I think that would be a big mistake strategically. And let's also not forget, we've got the entire rest of the Persian Gulf nations around that have also suffered a lot of political and economic damage as a result of this war. So they're certainly going to be trying to put pressure on the Israeli nation to also not disrupt it any further. So would he do something to try to save his political skin? Yes. What? I can't conjecture.
Wow, there's still a huge amount of uncertainty here. There really are more questions than answers, and that's one we will be following closely over the next 60 days. Indeed, well beyond that, it would seem. That's it from the podcast today. My thanks to Gina Amburzu. You can listen back to every episode of News Talk Daily on the Go Loud player. For now, for me, Ciara Doherty, have a fabulous weekend. Bye-bye.